Welcome to Neurosalience, the OHBM podcast.
Welcome to the Organization for Human Brain Mapping Neurosalience podcast. I'm Peter Banatini, and here I discuss all things brain imaging with scientists from around the world. Today, it's my great pleasure to talk with Dr. Jack Wells, who is a Wellcome Trust Career Development Fellow at the University College London Center for Advanced Biomedical Engineering. Jack received his PhD in MRI in the Department of Medical Physics and Bioengineering at the University College London in 2010. And since he began his scientific career, he's been working at the interface of MRI methodology and neurophysiology, focusing on understanding cerebral spinal fluid dynamics and how they may relate to the lymphatic system. He and colleagues have been among the leaders in using MRI to image and characterize the lymphatic system, as well as the brain-cerebral spinal fluid barrier. The lymphatic system is hypothesized to be the perivascular mechanism by which CSF is washed through brain tissue, typically during sleep, clearing out metabolic waste. It's an incompletely understood, yet potentially profoundly important system, where its dysfunction may be at the root of disorders that include Alzheimer's disease. This was a wonderful conversation, all about Jack's and others' work imaging and understanding the hydrodynamics and spatial organization of neurofluids in the brain. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Today I have Dr. Jack Wells, on the podcast. He's from the University College London. And welcome, Jack.
Hi, Peter. I'm a fan of the podcast, so it's great to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thanks for taking the time to be on. And I'm always, you know, it's like I'm always whenever I hear people listen to the podcast, I'm always step back and think, you know, oh, you listen to the podcast. This is great. Oh, I appreciate it. I'm always a little bit surprised that it's out there, since I have so much fun doing it. I just do it as an end in itself, and it's great. It's great that people listen. I really appreciate your listening. So today, actually, we're talking about something different than fMRI. Something that's sort of we'll get into a little bit later, but it's sort of using MRI to look at the lymphatic system. And you have been, and I haven't been following the literature super closely, but you have been really doing some of the most compelling and believable and best work about the lymphatic system and related, processes that involve the CSF and whatever. But before we get into that, we'll talk all about that. I just wanted to start out. I usually like to start at the very beginning, on yourself, and people like to know where people came from, how they became interested in MRI or the field that they're in, and for you, how you started on this path of looking at the lymphatic system as well. So, yeah.
I think so. So going back a long way now, at school, I just liked physics because I found that the easiest, and it's so hard to know what you want to do when you're young. And I considered doing medicine, the only reason being that I used to watch the program ER on a Wednesday night with my mum and dad. But I did work experience at a hospital and spoke to these doctors who were exhausted. And they tell me, if you do medicine, you really want to have to do it. You have to be 100% committed. And based on this advice, I compromised and I did a degree in physics with medical physics at UCL. And during this time, I didn't really apply myself to the best of my ability because I was young and foolish, but I did apply myself in a final year project in the medical physics department. This is where the idea of research really clicked for me for the first time. This is with Dr. Claire Elwell and Terence Leung, and this project involved near infrared spectroscopy, trying to look at blood flow to the forearm during different exercise paradigms. And this involved using this very old NIRS system from the 80s that lived in this kind of broom cupboard closet. And they trained me up in the system and really let me just get on with it. And I love the idea of having kind of agency and having independence in my own project. And I'd recruit my friends. I'd do the measurements, analyze the data, try and make the measurement better. And I kind of loved that loop of doing that until you get to a stage where you think you can measure something that's real. And I was then very fortunate to join a PhD. This was with Dr. David Thomas in Queen's Square. And David had been awarded a Wellcome Trust Fellowship to develop arterial spin labeling methods to image brain perfusion. David, this was a great stroke of luck because David was a fantastically kind and supportive mentor who, just a really clever bloke, always gets to the heart of any MR physics problem that you can throw at him. And it was from this that my love of MR kind of really started. And David had this great project which involved using ASL with a multiple echo time readout in order to try to get to the bottom of the origin of the ASL signal, which is a project which I loved, something that I've revisited a few times in my career, and it really, really started from there.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's great. And then, it seems that you've been at UCL since the beginning and worked yourself up and it seems that the people that you collaborate with are, and that now your own program is really building on this theme of using, for instance, using MRI or using, starting out with perfusion imaging, but then looking at using multi-echo to, as you say, look at the origins of this signal. You've also, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, put in diffusion imaging as well. So let's just start with that first paper. You're collaborating, and I recognize, aside from your advisor, I recognize Mark Lithgow. And I just, at the very beginning, I just want to mention, I know Mark Lithgow. He seems like he quite a charismatic character. And I remember distinctly early in the early days, in the early 2000s, at a meeting on blood flow, and he was there. And we, in the evening, it was actually at a castle in Germany, sponsored by the Max Planck Institute. And in the evening, we would go up to this top room, a small room in the castle, and play ping pong. And I just, it was almost like a surreal experience of playing ping pong with all these luminaries in the field. And it was kind of like a waking dream in some sense.
Can you remember who was the champion that night?
It was actually, so Rick Buxton and I teamed up, and it was in, we were the two Americans actually in the group. And fortunately, somehow we were good enough to become to beat all comers in that contest. So it was a lot of fun. So
Mark founded and directs the UCL Center for Advanced Biomedical Imaging, where I moved to for my postdoc. And he's there set up this brilliant lab where there is all these dedicated preclinical imaging equipment. So we're lucky to have two high field MR scanners. We've got PET, SPECT, ultrasound, photoacoustic imaging, and microscopy. And CABI, which Mark directs, has been a brilliant and really supportive and inspiring environment, which he allows researchers to really pursue their research interests. So it's been a great place to work over the past few years.
Yeah, that sounds like an ideal environment. In fact, yeah, I mean, it's something to say for being, I mean, I see why you've decided to sort of stay on, because that having an environment like that with everyone sort of on the same sort of wavelength in terms of what they care about, and having all these tools at hand really does help as far as that's concerned. Trying to sort of build that yourself if you're a little bit isolated is extremely difficult. And on top of that, finding people to talk to and bounce ideas off of, there's a lot to say for that as well. So, but let's just maybe go into that first paper just to have a window into your thought process. And when I first saw this paper, I thought, okay, so it's ASL with multi-echo. And about the same time, Hanzeng Liu was coming through with this sequence called TRUST, in which he did ASL with multi-echo, but for a different purpose, to try to characterize the oxygenation of the tagged blood. And trying to come up with a quantitative oxidation measure. But here you sort of varied it a little bit, and you might as well talk about that just a little bit, because it sort of illustrates the general theme of what you do.
Yeah, I really like the TRUST technique, and I always am very interested to see the methods that Hanzeng Liu develops. But you're absolutely right. The way that the sequences work are more or less identical. And the main difference is just the region in which we're looking. So Hanzeng Liu looks at the large arteries or the large veins, and he measures the T2, and the idea being that the T2 is very closely related to the oxygenation through these calibration curves, particularly if you measure the hematocrit. And Hanzhang Lu isolates the signal from the arteries or veins by using ASL to avoid partial volume effects, and can then get these kind of global measures of oxygen consumption.
Yeah.
So we're doing ASL with a multi-echo readout, but we're looking more at the tissue. And so we're looking more at the kind of microvasculature and the capillary. And the idea is that there will hopefully be a difference in the T2 of the blood and the T2 of the tissue. And as in ASL, you label blood water, and as it traverses the vascular tree, eventually the water molecules, because they're so small, can quite readily cross the blood-brain barrier into the tissue. And so if you can try to estimate the distribution of blood water that's in the vessels versus that in the tissue, then this can hopefully tell you something about the permeability of the blood-brain barrier to water. So this is the kind of idea of the multi-echo ASL technique.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's actually, and it does a good job as far as that's concerned. And so just to clarify, it was in the Journal of Cerebral Blood Flow and Metabolism, and it came out in 2009. So that was, and then you sort of built on that theme. So, but before we get into that, you know, you have all these tools at hand, and we'll get into how they're used. I mean, you have ASL, you have multi-echo, which actually, depending on the echo time, you can look at, you know, you can look at the oxidation effect, but you can also go out to very long echoes and look at just CSF. Has such a long T2, everything else dies away. It's a beautiful way of isolating that. Diffusion imaging. You might as well do the talking. As far as, you know, what other tools at hand, like you could modulate diffusion imaging. To look at in the context of like what Libby Han did, sort of trying to capture apparent or pseudo diffusion coefficients of, you know, with capillary flow, or in this case, as we'll talk about, with convection of blood of water. Yeah, let's get into the glymphatic system. What this podcast is about. So why don't we set it up to describe what is the glymphatic system? When was it discovered? Who discovered it?
Yeah, there's so much to say here. Would you like the short, the medium, or the long answer, do you think, at this stage?
Maybe the medium one.
Medium, okay. Medium sounds good. I guess we could maybe start with why this might be important from a disease perspective. And if we think about Alzheimer's disease, this is thought to be initiated by the gradual accumulation of this sticky protein. And then some patients 20 years later experience clinical symptoms such as memory loss. And there is evidence that amyloid beta accumulates not because of increased rates of production, but because of decreased rates of clearance. So it looks like amyloid accumulation is a problem of brain clearance. And there is a number of different ways in which amyloid is cleared from the brain. And one of these appears to be the cerebral spinal fluid, the CSF. And the precise kind of pathways and anatomical routes by which this occurs was not well understood, and certainly wasn't a great deal of research focus on this prior to the introduction of the glymphatic system. But we know this must occur because there is a correlation, for example, between radiological markers of brain pathology and CSF samples via lumbar puncture. Yeah. And if we go back a few years to the kind of classical perspective of CSF physiology that you'd read in a biology textbook, you would read that CSF is produced in the ventricles by this functional tissue called the choroid plexus. It then flows around the internal cavities. It is then absorbed at the level of the subarachnoid space back into the blood. Yep. And so the classical view of CSF circulation doesn't in any way describe any kind of interaction of the CSF with the brain tissue itself. And the glymphatic hypothesis really challenges this classical perspective and argues, in fact, CSF is rapidly exchanging with the brain's interstitial space in a physiologically meaningful way. And it does this, to quote Jeffrey Iliff's TED talk, which is really compelling, I recommend viewing if you haven't seen it. It does this by following this particular network of plumbing that they have coined the glymphatic system. And the glymphatic hypothesis describes how CSF is transported towards the brain along paravascular channels, or more specifically, para-arterial channels. This is not inside the blood vessel, but just either side.
Yes.
The CSF then exchanges into the tissue through the end feet of astrocytes. And this inflow and exchange then creates a convective flux of fluid that washes over the brain tissue, taking with it potentially harmful material, including amyloid beta. These then leave the brain along paravenous channels. So we have para-arterial inflow, convective flux, paravenous outflow. And an important component of this system appears to be the presence of these tiny bidirectional water channels, aquaporin 4, that sit at the end feet of astrocytes to separate the paravascular compartment from the tissue compartment. And the introduction of the glymphatic system has kind of reinvigorated the field of study of CSF, ISF, or interstitial fluid exchange, and it's brought people from many fields together to try to study the system.
Yeah, that's an amazing encapsulation of it. And then of course, people are aware of the fact that the glymphatic system appears to be more active, you know, as you're sleeping, which is interesting in itself, is that, you know, people, you know, then say, well, you know, sleep is very important, make sure you get your good sleep. But it really is interesting that this is something that I think the general public isn't aware of, that it, like you said at the very beginning, that these protein accumulations are, it's not because there's somehow some pathological accumulation. Well, it might be potentially, but it's mostly the current thinking is that it's the clearance, it's the efficiency of clearing it that makes a difference. Right. So when Jeffrey Liff and also Helen Benaviste and Macon Neergaard, when they discovered this, it was using tracers, animal model, and you might mention that briefly, just how they actually first realized this.
Yes. So the principal methods involved injecting fluorescent tracers into the CSF in anesthetized mouse models. And they found when they injected tracers into this particular point called the cisterna magna, just the back of the cerebellum, they waited half an hour, took the brain out, sliced it up, put it under a microscope. And in terms of this small fluorescent red tracer, they observed its presence in 90% of the brain tissue voxels that they looked at, which gives rise to this idea of this kind of brain-wide pathway. When they injected larger tracers, they found these got stuck in the kind of para-arterial channels, informing the para-arterial component of their hypothesis. And conversely, when they injected tracers directly into the tissue, they found these seemed to co-localize to paravenous compartments, informing the paravenous kind of outflow component of their pathway. And a really nice element of these experiments is when they injected the tracers into the cisterna magna, they actually removed CSF at the same rate so as not to kind of perturb the system. And this is a real feature of trying to study these really slow and subtle brain fluid movements, is that the measurements can easily be perturbed by the delivery of tracers or the potentially invasive mode of observation.
And so, right, as soon as that paper came out, then many people in the MR field, all the physicists, I think, got a little bit excited because they're thinking, okay, this is really an important system. It might be some indication, early indication of Alzheimer's pathology or you know, have some sort of clinical relevance. How can we image it non-invasively? And so I was one of those people who was thinking, you know, I have my sort of research that I was doing and I, you know, there were a few people at the NIH where I talked to and I was thinking more along the lines of like, okay, so I don't know how rapidly this convection goes, but maybe with diffusion imaging, you could, you know, at the right sensitization, you could be sensitized to that. But we tried a few things and it kind of worked, but it wasn't totally convincing. You know, your papers actually use a completely a different approach, at least some of them. Some of them use, well, we'll get into that as well, but might as well describe what you did and where that idea you think may have originated, but how you implemented it and why it works so well.
So I guess maybe going back a step. So the first time I was introduced to the glymphatic system was because of the sleep paper in Science. And they observed that the glymphatic function operated really effectively in sleep, as you described earlier, but seemed to be completely abolished when the mouse was awake. And in order to explain this observation, they captured a 60% increase in the volume of the extracellular space in the sleeping brain in comparison to the awake brain, and argued that this kind of reduces the resistance to the inflow of CSF into the tissue. My experience was actually because of that result, a lot of people with MR scanners, the first thing that they did, because diffusion is so wonderfully sensitive to changes in microstructure and compartmentation, was they tried to see whether they could capture this putative expansion of the extracellular space with standard diffusion imaging. And this was difficult because it meant getting someone to fall asleep in the scanner doing simultaneous EEG. And interestingly, I don't think that much data has been published to capture this effect, which I think is quite interesting, because intuitively diffusion MRI should be so sensitive to this. Yeah. For some reason, there's been some studies, and maybe it just reflects the technical difficulty of these measures. But in my experience, that was the kind of first thing that people tried, because on paper, it should be quite straightforward. But for some reason, that quite hasn't quite come to fruition as much as we might have thought.
Yes.
So I started a Wellcome Trust, coming back to my own work, I started a Wellcome Trust Fellowship in 2017 with the aim of trying to non-invasively capture the lymphatic system. And one of the ways I thought that this might be a kind of plausible angle was going back to this idea of trying to use MRI to measure water flux across the blood-brain barrier. And I've been using multiple echo ASL, but other groups have been using diffusion-weighted ASL. And this is a method that had been applied clinically and preclinically. It was quite well established. But I remember Maika Nudigar giving a talk, and she said that 99.7% of the outer surface area of blood vessels was covered by the end feet of astrocytes. And within this, about 50% of the surface area was occupied by aquaporin 4. And it was known from these MR measurements that blood water readily crosses the blood-brain barrier very quickly. And so from Maika's description, I kind of thought that surely the principal determinant of this rapid flux of water has to be aquaporin 4 because of this potential huge capacity for transport. And so I thought that if we do these blood-brain barrier water permeability measures, they could potentially be incredibly sensitive to aquaporin 4 polarization. Yeah. And it's aquaporin 4 polarization, which means that specifically the expression of aquaporin 4 at the blood-brain interface, that seemed to be an important driver of efficient lymphatic flow. So I thought that this would be something feasible we could measure with MR that would represent a surrogate index of lymphatic aquaporin 4 enabled lymphatic function. So it's not directly measuring interstitial CSF exchange, but something a bit different. And so this was work that was brilliantly led by a PhD student called Yolanda Heaney, and we managed to obtain an aquaporin 4 knockout mouse. And we developed the technique in the mouse brain, and encouragingly, we did see an increased exchange time, the average time that it takes for the labeled water to cross from the blood into the tissue in the aquaporin 4 knockout mouse, about a 30% increase, which was a great start, and it was really encouraging that the hypothesis proved to be correct. But on the other hand, in the knockout, water still did readily cross from the blood into the tissue. So it must be doing this via other routes.
Yeah.
And then sure enough, when we applied the technique to an aged mouse model, from previous studies, it's been shown that aquaporin 4 polarization actually reduces with age. So we thought there would be decreased permeability. But actually, we saw evidence for increased permeability, which suggests that there are other changes at the blood-brain barrier, aside from aquaporin 4, that enable this transport of water that we can measure so well with MRI. And so it looks like these measures are not a specific measure of aquaporin 4 polarization as we hoped, but I still think the study was useful in order to begin to kind of dissect the different changes at the blood-brain barrier that account for differences in water permeability that we can detect clinically very well these days.
Yes.
So that was one avenue that we investigated. And the other was trying to target the perivascular space, since this is the kind of gateway for the lymphatic system. And one way of starting with this, as you alluded to, is just going to a very long echo time to try to isolate that CSF signal. And in the context of just imaging the structure of the perivascular space, I'd only really seen this in the context of MR in looking for radiological markers of small vessel disease, where you see this expansion. I'd never really seen a MR image showing this kind of characteristic train track structure or morphology that you see in the two photon images that describe perivascular flow. And so we were looking for this structure, and when we found it around the MCA at the ventral aspect of the rat brain. So it was a fairly upstream location. But a lot of studies using tracers, like those from Helen Benavista, have shown that this location appears to be a really important route in which tracers directed in the cisterna magna are kind of trafficked towards the brain tissue.
Yeah.
And so looking at the MCA, an upstream region, the perivascular space still seemed to me a kind of sensible target for a non-invasive method. And then trying to think of a functional readout, I had to go with phase contrast, didn't have a lot of success because I think the velocities are so slow. I tried the time slip method, and I almost got it to work, so that I could see movement in the subarachnoid space, but not the perivascular space. And so I then went back to diffusion, and this brings me to one of the controversies of the lymphatic system, which is the nature of perivascular flow. And some people think that really what's dominating the observed movement of tracers is this idea of pulsatile-driven dispersive flow. And if this is the case, diffusion MRI should be dead sensitive to detect this. But if there was a degree of bulk flow, I'd done some work, and this goes back to your discussion with Denny Lebihan about this idea of kind of perfusion tensor imaging, showing that if we use ASL combined with low B value diffusion gradients, we can capture a coherent component of flow because, of course, it's non-plug. So either way, I thought diffusion would be a good place to start. And just to give us confidence that the method was working, we know that the movement of fluid runs parallel to the perivascular space. And our hypothesis was that if we measured diffusion in this direction parallel, it would be greater than perpendicular. And this is what we saw. And we followed this up and showed that we could gate this measurement to demonstrate that we can capture the action of the blood vessels driven by the heartbeat to propel perivascular fluid movement in a very directional fashion. And so I think the problem with this technique is it cannot distinguish. It's semi-quantitative. We cannot get velocity. We cannot distinguish bulk flow from dispersive, but it has really nice sensitivity in terms of the directionality, the sensitivity to the heartbeat. And so it might be a useful biomarker moving forward.
That's interesting. So have you tried, there's so many questions with everything that you mentioned. You pretty much described all of your, not all of it, but really nicely as far as the summary of what you're doing. A couple of questions regarding the convection flow. What velocity ranges are we talking about here in terms of CSF?
So there was a breakthrough in 2018, a really nice paper from the Nierdegaard, Douglas Kelly, and Maestra, Nature Communications, where they used two photon imaging, but they used larger traces, some microspheres. This is around a peel vessel in the mouse brain. And this meant that they could actually track the individual trajectories of these traces.
Yeah.
And if you see that paper, interestingly, they appear to move monotonically, which provides really strong evidence for bulk flow in this compartment. And the estimated velocities were about 20 micrometers per second. Okay. So it's slow, which explains why phase contrast was very difficult for me at the time.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of physiological process we're trying to detect. It's very, very challenging.
Yeah, it's tricky. And right, as far as and as far as the tag for the ASL, is there any choice in terms of certainly for blood, you just want to tag down here, but you're still tagging blood, but because you're using such a long echo time, you're getting mostly the tag of the CSF. Is that the idea essentially? Or
so maybe you're talking about the technique that we use to look at the blood CSF barrier.
Right. I'm sorry, I'm jumping back and forth.
Okay. Yeah. No worries. Yes. So this was it's just because we were thinking about the glymphatic system. I learned to appreciate the kind of significance of the choroid plexus, which it's not directly linked to glymphatics, which is all about CSF-ISF exchange,
right.
But it's most famous for being the kind of source of CSF replenishment in the brain, and it sits in the ventricles. And it just does all this really unique function in support of brain health, but I think has been hugely understudied. One reason, because it's a very difficult thing to measure the function of. And trying to think why there were no reports of just using, at the time, using ASL to measure choroid plexus perfusion or FDG PET, and BOLD we can't do because there aren't really any neurons, so we can't look at neurovascular coupling. I think the problem was partial volume effects, because it's a very kind of fine and delicate region, and if you try and superimpose your chunky slices and big voxels that you use in functional imaging, partial volume is problematic. So to try to get around this, I thought a nice idea would just be to do ASL, but then have a very, very long echo time readout. So you're just measuring signal from the CSF. And because the blood CSF barrier is so exquisitely designed to interface the blood and the CSF, and because measures of blood-brain barrier water exchange tend to be quite quick, I thought within the timescale of an ASL measurement, we might be able to capture the transfer of labeled water from the blood into the CSF, a process mediated by the blood CSF barrier. And this might be quite a nice way of getting around those partial volume effects to try to specifically look at blood CSF barrier function.
Okay. So what about, going back to the question of the velocities, and so just even further back to answer maybe a question I've had as far as, do people understand why it is that when people are sleeping, the intracellular, the extracellular space sort of fills up, and what is the mechanism by which that happens? You look at the movies that are created, and it's just, like you said, with the labeled tracers, it's just incredible how it seems to sort of, you know, it goes slower than the flow, but it seems to follow in some sort of a you know, constant velocity, but and it just stops completely when they're awake. But so does anyone know this mechanism, like what the actual mechanism is for when a person's asleep?
I don't know if this was demonstrated in their paper. I imagine it would have been something that's been looked at subsequently, but I'm not very on top of that literature, actually. So right. I'm not sure if the mechanisms that mediated this expansion of the extracellular space are really described at this moment in time.
Okay. And also, I you know, thinking about the expansion of extracellular space and why people trying to use, you know, a certain diffusion weighting, you know, initially, I mean, if you have varying success in seeing it, so you would have thought that, right. I mean, is it the diffusion coefficient from intercellular versus extracellular? People are sort of revising their models where they're now saying, well, it's more just electrostatic, you know, proximity to the cell membrane. And so that might not change quite as much as the fraction of intracellular versus extracellular. So as far as going into more detail, as far as, yeah, just putting aside your ASL. Yeah. Apologies for jumping back and forth like that, but I had a few questions simultaneously in my mind. So as far as what you did with this, and you found that with the cardiac cycle, there was some variation across the cardiac cycle. You just sent me some of your latest work on that. I want to describe that a little bit as well.
Yeah. So going back to those two photon images, it really looks like the microspheres in the perivascular space where they looked at were propelled forward by the vascular pulsation driven by the heartbeat. And so this has been, it's been coined a perivascular pumping, this idea that it's this vascular pulsation that is driving the movement of perivascular fluid towards the tissue. And those two photon imaging data do look quite convincing. So we wanted to try to see whether we could capture this effect with MRI. And so we just gated our acquisitions to multiple kind of ECG delay times. And what was quite nice is that when we look at the kind of timing corresponding to the peak of vascular pulsation, we can see marked directionality of our diffusion measurements. And when we go to systole, this goes pretty much to zero. So it's quite nice to be able to have that kind of dynamic range when we look at the directionality of our diffusion measures of perivascular fluid movement. And if you compare the kind of time course of our cardiac dependent diffusion measures to the velocity captured using the two photon data by the Nidegaard and Douglas Kelly's group, they do look quite similar. So hopefully we're capturing kind of similar processes. And in the paper that you mentioned, we kind of repeated their experiment of using a pharmacological model of acute hypertension to reduce vascular pulsation. And yeah, we showed that in doing so, we can in turn see a marked decrease in the directionality of our diffusion, which suggests that we can use this technique to image the kind of dysfunction of perivascular pumping that can occur in this model.
Okay. So really, so a little bit more of a nitty-gritty sort of question as I, you know, looking into those papers. So just to reiterate, I mean, somewhere in the conversation, it may have been lost a little bit from my jumping around to the ASL approach. So the basic idea is that you're selecting the water by having a long echo time, and then you're applying the you know, a B factor of with various orientations to get at that movement. And so the movement, the B factor was about in the range of 200 or something like that. And,
yeah, it was about 100 originally. And now we've moved down to 40.
Oh, down to 40. Mm, yeah. Okay. All right. So then, but so it seems to me that, I mean, I'm sure you've done this as well, sort of parametrically varying the B factor to see if there's any sort of, you know, if I can imagine as you go to higher B factors or B values, the directionality, the anisotropy would change. I mean, there's so much information with, and if you went either further down, you might, right. I mean, it would be interesting to see parametrically varying the, you know, the echo time and the B factor to sort of paint this whole picture about, you know, what's going on and where exactly it's going on and making maps of those.
Yeah, we haven't really explored parameter space within these type of measurements as much as we would have liked to, because I think you're right, there could be some really new and exciting information there. And I do quite like, as you were alluding to, I quite like that, I think in IVIM, the D star corresponding to the intravascular component is about, I think, two orders of magnitude greater than the ADC. Yeah. And here we're kind of in this intermediate component, which maybe we can kind of capture and exploit to tell us something about cardiac-driven CSF motion. And so Phoebe Evans, who led a lot of this work, in her thesis, she did some multiple B-value measurements of the perivascular space. And it broadly seemed to follow a fairly mono-exponential model when we looked at it. And so nothing hugely kind of exciting dragged out, but we are limited a bit in spatial resolution. And if we had better spatial resolution, we could maybe disentangle the kind of difference in flow that might occur at different kind of compartments of the perivascular space, but we're not able to do that at the moment. I should say that this idea has been really taken forward and advanced in the human brain by Lydian Hirschler and Matthias van Osch. And in the human brain, you just get so much more kind of spatial detail, and they're able to image the perivascular space much further down the vascular tree. And they've got these measurements with cardiac and diffusion gating and have these really beautiful videos that they generated. So I think they're kind of really leading the field now in terms of where this method might go.
Okay. That's great. That's really exciting. And you know, people might think, oh, well, is it, you know, right. Of course you have cardiac, you have bulk motion, you have, you know, in some sense, you're getting rid of all of that by going to such long echo times and some of the artifactual signal changes. But is that still a worry? I mean, how much, for instance, for any experiment you have to do, how long do you have to average to actually get a meaningful signal?
You're absolutely right. So for the blood CSF barrier technique, I'm sorry to jump back to that again, we can go to 220 milliseconds. And so we're kind of unambiguously nulling the signal from tissue and blood there. But here we're kind of in the middle, and we're definitely trying to weight our signal to the perivascular space to reduce partial volume effects. But we can't extend it too much because the SNR just goes down so much. So I guess MR, it's always that compromise between accuracy and precision. And I think that is an important consideration in this technique, because we do see a little bit of signal from the tissue. And as you go further down to the smaller perivascular spaces, that could be an issue. So I think that's something to watch out for with this method, and something that hopefully we'll find the best compromise.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So maybe we should talk a little bit about the other methods. I mean, they're not your methods, but it's they're, you know, looking through the literature. So right, so there's one by the Johns Hopkins group, in which, yeah, it almost, as I was reading these papers, it looked like it was sort of the in some sense they're using magnetization transfer contrast. It seems like they're nulling CSF, looking at NT contrast and seeing how that changes with. So maybe you can describe it better than I can, since I've just been sort of studying it recently. It seems like the opposite. It seems like the mirror image of your approach.
So these are two really smart papers, I think. These are great ideas that I wish I thought of myself. And I think the basic idea is that one uses magnetization transfer, kind of labeling of the tissue, and then tries to measure the rate at which this water or the label is transferred to the CSF. And the other uses a kind of T1 nulling approach. And because glymphatics is all about CSF-ISF exchange, I think this approach makes a lot of sense in terms of using MR to try to measure this process. Interestingly, they record very large flow values from the tissue into the CSF. I think they report values of about 1,000 milliliters per 100 grams per minute, which is 6-7 times greater than perfusion. And so this does raise a slight question marks about their data. However, to my mind, they've taken kind of necessary and careful steps to mitigate any possible confounders. And both of these two separate techniques give very similar values. And in fairness to the authors, I don't think this physiological process that they're capturing has ever been measured by any other previous technique. So it's a bit difficult to say whether it's wrong or not. And also, it's quite a difficult thing to know how to modulate, you know, a drug or a challenge or a model. I don't know that there's any kind of precedent for this method, but so this, nonetheless, it's quite hard to reconcile physiologically such high flow rates, and you might think this might have been picked up before. However, if it is true, the sensitivity of this method is potentially very high indeed, and so I think it has potential, but maybe the next stage is for it to be independently verified and tested and modulated in some way. But I do think these ideas are really nice and quite exciting.
Yeah, well, just out of curiosity, it might be indirectly related, is, you know, what are the, like, the rates of CSF inflow and outflow in the brain? I mean, how quickly is it recycled versus what the rate of, you know, blood flow in the brain versus outflow? Is it, you know, when you compare perfusion and CSF exchange, you know, they're two separate systems. So is one much higher than the other, or, you know, are there numbers on that?
So in terms of CSF secretion by the choroplexus in the human brain, it's 500 milliliters per day, and we've got about 150 milliliters in our brain. So it's thought to be turned over about 4 to 5 times per day. In the mouse brain, which they studied, it's a bit faster. I think it's about 12 times is turned over in a 24-hour period. That's still quite slow.
Yeah.
And in terms of the lymphatics that we've discussed, again, the flow rates are relatively subtle, 20 micrometers per second. And so the rates they're observing here, CSF in the ventricles would be replenished, I think, once every 6 seconds, once every 10 seconds. So it is hard to kind of reconcile those flow rates on other measures of brain fluid movement, but maybe this is hitting on this idea of kind of equilibrium water exchange, which is maybe what the techniques are picking up, versus this idea of kind of net secretion and net fluid movement, which is more picked up when you use larger contrast agents. So maybe it's just a case of looking at water, as they're doing in these papers, versus large contrast agents looking at the kind of net flow. But it is hard. The flow rates are so high, it is hard to fully get a picture of what's going on at this time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, part of the fun challenge of sort of understanding what you're sensitized to with MRI, with any of these techniques, I mean, to me, there's different levels of being convincing. One is it sort of fits with the physiologic models, and two, you know, the maps. I mean, if you make maps of this, if you ultimately make maps, they start to look in some way convincing. They seem like they're in the right places in the right ways. And also, if you modulate the exchange, I mean, you could modulate aquaporin or during sleep versus wake, and to be able to see a modulation. But then ultimately, right, if they predict, I mean, clinically, you ultimately want to use them to have populations where you have people with Alzheimer's or mouse models with Alzheimer's, which groups have done as well.
They've looked at the dynamic time courses as well, which is another way of trying to gain confidence by changing the effective post-labeling delay. And you do see this, what looks like a plausible kind of kinetic delivery and then decay, which again suggests they're on the right lines. But I think, more work is to be done, but it is exciting.
Yeah. And before we jump back to one of your papers, actually, that reminds me of I thought it was really nice sort of collection of pharmacologic manipulations and then showing these changes. But before we get to that, and also just to mention Laura Lewis's paper on looking at, you know, the fourth ventricle and CSF pulsatility. And, you know, obviously people try to sort of tie this in with the glymphatic systems. Never in the papers did you say it was a glymphatic system, but also I think that the paper itself, you know, was looking at this inflow effect. You know, if you have this, you know, that basically that, and you can describe this probably definitely better than I can, as far as, you know, that there's a changing of a direction of the CSF flow when the subjects are sleeping. And so that's indication of, you know, this hyper, you know, perfusion of, not perfusion, but of, you know, of increase of this glymphatic process. But that was sort of indirectly implied. But so it, you might want to mention that as well. How does that tie in to the whole story with you as far as what Laura Lewis saw?
Yeah, and this is such an exciting paper. And I think you're probably better equipped to speak about this more than I am, about the other techniques. But this was a combined, in humans, this combined EEG fMRI study, and they got the volunteers to sleep in the scanner, which is something that's very difficult to do, and they convincingly demonstrated sleep. And what they found was they looked at the BOLD signal and they looked at the EEG, and you see these kind of slow waves of a BOLD signal that start to occur in sleep. And what was really exciting is that, as you say, they had a measure of kind of bulk CSF flow by looking at the fourth ventricle, and they found that when these slow wave BOLD signals begin to die down, they saw this quite significant inflow of CSF. Yeah. And so they demonstrated this really tight kind of temporal coupling of neuronal BOLD and CSF signals, and this occurs yes. during sleep. And when they looked at the CSF fluctuations due to the cardiac and respiratory motion, they were much smaller than what they were observing. And this was, a beautiful study and really, really interesting data. And I think they've since followed up to show that this can be also observed in task-based fMRI using visual stimulation,
yeah.
which provides more evidence that there is a kind of causal relationship there. As you alluded to, I think there is a big jump between a measurement of bulk CSF flow in the fourth ventricle and glymphatics, which is looking at inflow into the tissue. And after all, people have been looking at bulk CSF flow using phase contrast MR for a very long time, and I don't think this is quite glymphatics, but it's really exciting, and it would be great if they were to perform similar measurements, but then try to get a measure of glymphatic flow to see whether it is this neuronal vascular slow wave signal that is driving CSF into the tissue.
Yeah, you know, when I hear about this work, and which it really is beautiful work, and I, you know, immediately start thinking, oh, there must be better ways of, you know, phase contrast or, you know, other ways of imaging, you know, CSF flow in this way. But at the same time, also, I'm still struck with the idea that, you know, when you're sleeping, your cells sort of contract and your extracellular fluid increases. And it seems that the CSF, I mean, and that causes an increase in this flow of CSF. I'm really surprised that it hasn't been seen before. And if there's other ways of modulating this, like either with, going to your paper now, either with changing blood pressure or increasing CO2 breathing. Like, so if you increase the blood volume, you would think that would change the how much CSF is there. I mean, as Laura Lewis sort of implied by activation, I guess. So, yeah, you have this paper in which you actually did a number of manipulations, changed the blood pressure, changed, gave them caffeine, which would cause a certain amount of vasoconstriction. Might as well describe that and see, and maybe describe what it implies about your sensitivity to these processes.
So, off the back of this technique that we developed to look at the function of the choroid plexus or the blood CSF barrier, and we measure the delivery of the labeled blood across the blood CSF barrier into the tissue. And so this is going to be sensitive to the mass of the choroid plexus, convolved with its perfusion and convolved with the permeability to water. And because this was a non-invasive technique, traditionally choroid plexus function is measured using microspheres for a single time point, very invasive measure. But this, of course, means that it's great for doing repeated measures to look at the effect of drugs. And we wanted to, because this allows us to do that, we wanted to think about some kind of reactivity studies, because a lot of people think that rather than baseline perfusion, if you challenge the vasculature, image its dilatory ability, this is a more sensitive indicator of vascular health. And so we wanted some ways which we could challenge the choroid plexus, change its perfusion, and change our measurement. And just starting with CO2, this is, of course, the most commonly way it's done in terms of the vessels that perfuse the parenchymal tissue. But we weren't too sure how this would affect choroid plexus perfusion and thus our measurement. And we did some pilot studies, and it looked like there might have been a differential response. But when we looked at a larger cohort, it looks like the change in our signal in the cortex and in the amount of labeled blood water delivered to the CSF was very similar. So it looks like CO2 has a similar effect on the blood vessels that supply the brain and the choroid plexus. But this still could be a nice way of investigating the vasculature. And vasopressin is a drug which is just fantastic in this context, because it has a very specific vasoconstrictive effect on the choroid plexus, with little change or a slight dilatory effect on blood vessels that perfuse the parenchyme. Yeah. And so this is a really nice way of initially us getting some confidence in the specificity of our signal. But also there are reports. So when we looked at age mice, we found that our measure of blood CSF barrier function was significantly reduced. And there are reports that as you get older, the amount of endogenous vasopressin in your system is increased. This is all work, by the way, led by a brilliant postdoc, Charith Pereira. There's a lot of his ideas. And so we thought vasopressin would be an interesting challenge in the aged brain, because perhaps the kind of saturation with endogenous vasopressin might reduce its effect to modulate the signal that we're measuring. And so what was quite nice is we showed that in the younger mice, we saw a significant constrictive effect with vasopressin, but this was markedly reduced when we sort of challenged the choroid plexus vessels in the age brain, perhaps suggesting that the vasopressin could be a a reason that kind of mediates this reduction in choroplexus function that we detected in the aged brain.
Interesting.
Okay, and so it was a kind of reactivity study, really, just because the method gives us this nice window into doing repeated measures and investigating the effects of drugs.
Okay. And so is the implication that, so once again, leading back to the CSF exchanges, the implication is that with older people, there's just less CSF produced due to this vasopressin effect. And so that's why there's less clearance in some sense, or?
So there are a few studies that have reported reduced CSF clearance with aging, and people think this could be particularly problematic because the ventricles expand, reduce CSF secretion, so the turnover gets less and less, and so yes, the CSF is replenished at a much reduced rate. And so this has been shown, for example, in one of Mike Niedergaard's recent papers, where she looked at the aged mouse brain and measured a significant reduction in CSF secretion. Our measure does not measure CSF secretion. I wish it did, because that would be such a useful physiological thing to measure. But our measure principally, as I described, reflects perfusion and an exchange. But an exciting observation is when we did apply the technique to aged mice, we did see a very marked reduction, so a 40% reduction, which was very similar to the percentage reduction in CSF secretion that Mike and Niedergaard reported in aged mice. So there are some reports that there can be a coupling of CSF secretion to choroplexus perfusion, but there is limited evidence to show that that is always the case in different diseases, etc. So that's something that we're looking to investigate at the moment by kind of comparing our measures to direct measures of CSF secretion. Sorry, Peter, I can't remember exactly what you asked me. I'll be rambling on a bit.
This is perfect. No, this is perfect. And so it, I mean, okay. So overall, right. I mean, I thought I'd mention three more papers, just really quickly related to this. So, you know, and credit to you, you've sort of pointed these papers out to me in my preparation for this podcast. Peter Basser, who's right in my institute at the NIH, inventor of diffusion tensor imaging, is investigating sort of approaches to using Q-space imaging, which is basically, you know, modulating your B factor in different dimensions to sort of making a three-dimensional construct of diffusion coefficient. And also with an interesting MR phantom that is trying to mimic this sort of effect of convection through, you know, a tortuous collection of cells. So what do you think of the promise of that? It's always hard to build physical phantoms of these things, but it is a nice way of tuning the sequence to make it know, you know, make you aware of what it's doing. What's your thoughts on Q-space imaging?
This is a really nice paper, and I think a key component of the glymphatic hypothesis is this idea of a convective flow in the interstitium, which is controversial, but you know, if we could measure it non-invasively, this would be tremendously exciting. And I think a phantom is a great place to start when you're developing these new techniques to look at very subtle flows. And I love this bead phantom that they've created to more accurately mimic the extracellular space. And yes, they applied Q-space imaging, which is a method I'm not very familiar with, to be honest, but I think it's looking at the phase of the signal and DTI. And what was really encouraging is they showed that they could measure, estimate an accurate velocity and see changes in the directionality of the DTI measures going down to velocities of about 70, 80 microns. So instead of demonstrating the potential surface sensitivity of this approach to detect this is really exciting. However, going back to the two-photon paper that I described, in the mouse brain in the perivascular space, the velocity was 20 microns per second. And you think this would be on the high end because everything is fast in the mouse brain, and then it's going to be slower in the tissue.
Yes.
If this is in the periarterial space. And so it might be that even at 70, that is not quite good enough to capture this process in vivo. And of course, going from phantom to in vivo always comes with lots of problems. But there is a lot of focus on white matter being kind of preferential pathways where bulk flow of fluid could take place. And so maybe that might be a good place to start going in vivo with this method. But I thought, it's a really nice paper to demonstrate the sensitivity of this approach.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's I'll definitely have to chat with him more. Maybe we'll try to get him on a podcast. Who knows? But there's one other technique, and I'm yeah. And once again, I just looked at these papers the other day, and from a group in Pan called DTI Alps, and there, at least from what I gather from this paper, they use a it's sort of similar. They do diffusion tensor. Diffusion imaging to look at this, but they actually have a B factor of like 1,000, which seems like it's sensitized to something else. But they seem like they have a couple of papers out in it right now that seem like they have results. So I'm kind of curious how this fits into the picture.
Yes. So in this method, I think the basic concept is they have this region just next to the ventricles, where they put these three regions of interest, and I think they're overlaid on the medullary veins, if I'm not pronouncing that incorrectly. And then they have a couple of B values and look at the kind of directionality or the ratio of the directionality of the different regions of interest. Okay. Being honest, I'm quite skeptical about this technique because it's controversial to what extent the perivascular space exists, a kind of dedicated fluid-filled compartment exists around the veins.
Yes.
And so to my understanding, that they haven't presented any evidence of how much of their signal contribution comes from the perivascular space. And I think that's important when trying to say that you're investigating lymphatics. And secondly, as you say, I'm not sure about the tuning of the B value. And so to my mind, there isn't really the experimental evidence to demonstrate that you are looking at the perivascular space or its motility. And right. There have been quite a few publications now using this technique and alluding to a measure of lymphatics. And I think, in my opinion, and I could be wrong because I haven't got hands on with the data. So I might be missing something, but in my opinion, I think it deserves greater scrutiny.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's wonderful that there's many different approaches like this. And as you know, it's something like this that comes along, previous podcasts, we talked about, direct neural imaging with Diana, and it sort of like causes the entire field to sort of take notice, to focus on the methods themselves and really sort of push and refine them. Hmm. And if anything, we bet we understand more of what the contrast means. And that's one of my favorite things about MRI is that you can actually, you have so many knobs to turn in terms of which contrast you can have. And then some combination of these might just exactly tune you to some process that you didn't. And so there's a sort of an iterative process of having a proof of concept of the contrast and imaging it better so that it can be useful in some sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So one last paper that I wanted to mention, Visa Kevin Yimi, and it's looking from a completely different angle, just simply looking at the dynamics of pulsatility, basically looking at the dynamics of oscillations in the brain and saying, okay, one might be bold contrast, using a technique called MREG, which allows you to do, it's basically fast magnetic resonance encephalography, claiming that there's three different frequencies in this really low frequency that's on the order of 0.05 hertz that some people have attributed to the vasomotion. And he's sort of mapping this and saying, well, could be also the waves of pulsation that slowly go through the brain that are related to the lymphatic system. It would be nice to have, it looks like the sequences are bold weighted for the most part, but who knows? It'd be nice to have a little bit more specific sensitization, but either way, it was an intriguing paper.
I remember seeing these guys present this actually before they published it, and they created these fantastic, beautiful videos showing the kind of spatial temporal progression of these different frequencies that they've looked at, and it's really compelling. And actually I was unaware that the kind of technological advancements that means you can acquire 10 images of the whole brain per second. It's just really, really amazing. I had no idea you could do this, and to see this applied to look at different frequencies of things going on in the brain was just really exciting, and the videos are fantastic. And I was unsure at the time what the, as you alluded to, what the contrast mechanism was for the MREG. And at the time, I don't think the answer to that was known, but I haven't really kept on top of that. And so maybe they've got to the bottom of that a bit more and tried to kind of tie down exactly what those low frequency changes are showing, but as a kind of new way of imaging the brain, I think it's tremendously exciting. And I don't know if there have been any direct studies showing how that correlates to measures of lymphatics.
Yes.
And whether that has been verified or not, but it is a technique. It's so exciting and has got great potential.
Yeah, it is interesting. Although I haven't seen anything from them. I mean, the paper came out in 2016. So, and I'll have to try to contact him. And so, you know, my group is trying to get the MREG sequence. But we don't, and because you're looking at such slow flow or slow changes, you don't necessarily need that. Standard echoplanar could work just fine. But who knows? I mean, once again, it's this amazing amount of fun that physicists working with pulse sequences have that isn't usually there. That parameter space isn't usually there in terms of, you know, using PET or other, you know, there's a different type of parameter space. But and so it seems that there's a lot of work to be done as far as that's concerned. So why don't we, we're getting up maybe close to the hour, just to sort of talk sort of open-ended about what the goal is in terms of sort of what specific types of information you're trying to get. And also just in general, what has surprised you most about what you could see or what you can't see? What's been frustrating? And where do you think this ultimately will go?
I think it's got CSF mediated clearance. It's got big potential when you see studies where they, for example, they tie off the cervical lymph nodes and this hugely increases deposition of amyloid. I think the evidence is there that the CSF plays a key role. And I think trying to get to the bottom of how this happens and whether we can image this in a practical and sensitive way is definitely a worthwhile pursuit. Yes. I think there are a lot of questions that need to be answered. I think from the kind of basic mechanisms perspective, I think it's important to point out that, the Nierdegaard group have really pushed the envelope and have made brilliant technical interventions. And I'm constantly wowed by their data and the thoroughness and the way they use different techniques to really provide confidence in what they're showing. But it's important to point out that there are people working in the field of brain fluid movement who are quite skeptical about some elements of the lymphatic pathway. And there's a really great review I'd recommend by Marjorie Barand and Stephen Klaudke in the journal Fluids and Barriers of the CNS. I think it's worth reading. And I think there are some controversial elements of the lymphatic system that I think could be kind of unambiguated to an extent by more direct invasive basic science measures. Yeah. And so, for example, I think there's a consensus about the para-arterial inflow of the pathway, but the paravenous exit routes are a little bit more controversial, and this also links to the idea as to what extent there is convective flow.
Yes.
And I think by really nailing down those basic science elements, then hopefully this can better inform as to how with MRI we can gain a kind of a meaningful insight into lymphatic function. We can measure a correlate of it that's kind of easy for us, possible for us to measure, that's going to provide real insight. I think addressing the issue of the sleep dependence is really important, because that sleep study in 2013 is technically so impressive, but it hasn't been independently reproduced. And this could just be because it's so difficult to get a mouse to stay up to naturally sleep, and it's such a difficult measurement. But I think it would be good to get a bit more independent verification of that, because it could be, for example, that by doing MR measures of lymphatics in people who are awake, it doesn't tell us anything useful about what really goes on during sleep. So trying to understand that a bit better, I think, would be really useful. And I think the field's wide open for someone to come in and make a real breakthrough in terms of an imaging technique that could tell us more about this, whether it's the kind of Laura Lewis's approach of looking at the neurovascular coupling and getting a more direct measure of lymphatic clearance, or the CSF ISF exchange method, but looking at the perivascular space rather than the ventricles. So I think there's great potential there, but I think a few basic science questions that would kind of inform the MR physics development would be useful.
Yes. Yeah. So, but you had mentioned just really, really quickly. So about the controversy of whether it's para-arterial, it goes to paravenous space. Is there an alternative hypothesis as to what happens potentially? Because I'm thinking, where else would it go? Would it go into the cells? Would it, carried out by the veins themselves? Or what are the other thoughts of?
So there are some people who believe it's carried out by the para-arterial component. So this is the iPad hypothesis that was introduced by the late Roy Weller and Roxana Carrara at Southampton. And when they injected traces into the tissue, they found these were co-localized to the para-arterial space. And this is also consistent with observations of amyloid deposition in cerebral amyloid angiopathy. But these experiments are so difficult because it's so sensitive to the delivery of the tracer. And if you in any way perturb the system, it could influence where that tracer is seen. And it's also to be that the acts of fixing the tissue can dramatically change the distribution of the tracer. And unlike imaging of the para-arterial inflow, where you can take dynamic two-photon videos, when you're trying to inject into the tissue, you can only take single time point measurements. So you can't see the tracer going from A to B to C in order to really understand the route that it takes. And people think, for example, that by waiting half an hour, like they did in the 2012 paper, it may already have exited via para-arterial routes and you're just left with paravenous routes. It's also thought that the region that you're studying the interstitial outflow could be really important. And so this is such a difficult thing to measure. And people tend to inject in the cortex, but maybe this happens in different routes depending on proximity to large blood vessels. So it's just such a difficult thing to measure.
Yeah. Okay. But regardless though, I mean, right, there's enough other conversion evidence that there's, the process is, Acquaporin 4 is important, and there's certain things that are sort of in place as far as that's concerned. And people have measured, CSF content as it, the amount of amyloid within the CSF varies, day to night and things like that too. So there's lots, there is certainly converging evidence that this is an important process. And it's interesting. I immediately, when I saw the paper about the Acquaporin 4, I thought, oh, well, if there's some sort of therapy that could vary or increase or decrease the expression of Acquaporin 4 or something like that. And of course, you have problems both ways. If you have too much, you can get edema and problems in that sense. If you have too little, of course, you have less clearance. So there's a fine balance as far as that's concerned. I actually didn't quite get into one of your papers, and you had alluded to it earlier, and I'm so sorry for jumping around, but I was intrigued by looking at, and this, and so you did mention this, you were looking at the exchange with the exchange times with CSF, and you had mentioned, so in your paper, I thought I saw it correctly, and once again, I need to read these more carefully, that you were inferring from a three compartment model of exchange times of up to a minute or so. How did you actually do that, and what exactly does that mean? As far as, I mean, it seems like a measurement that, with MRI, everything's occurring in the order of hundreds of milliseconds, and so you're measuring signal, and maybe with your TR it goes up to about maybe 10 seconds, but being able to infer based on a model what exchange rates are out to a minute, what did you have to do?
So this answer is a little bit involved, but when I first developed the technique in the mouse brain, I just did ASL with a very long echo time reader, and I can see when the ASL signal first arrives in the ventricles, and this is like the arrival time, and this with normal ASL is the arterial transit time, but in this case it's the tissue transit time because we're not measuring signal from the vessels. And I could reproducibly say that this happens at about 700 milliseconds, so it's quite a fast process. So I collaborated with Leonie Petitclerc and Matthias van Osch in Leiden University, who really led the human work which you're describing, where they did long echo time ASL measurements. And there's quite a lot to talk about their paper, but what was really interesting is that we thought we would just measure signal from kind of the CSF co-localized to the choroid plexus, because this is what I'd observed. But in fact, the whole brain kind of just lit up. And we just observed just considerable transfer of labeled blood water into subarachnoid CSF compartments.
Okay.
And this is something that we really wrestled with, and Matthias and Leonie did the kind of necessary controls to convince ourselves it wasn't artifact. But so it happens at longer post-labeling delay times. But at the longer post-labeling delay times in a given cortical ROI, about 20% of the ASL signal is in the CSF, which is, just for me, the first thing that struck was that ASL is meant to be a kind of marker of tissue perfusion, marker of nutritive flow. And so yes. A lot going to the CSF was perhaps a worry in terms of accuracy for that measurement, but it is at the longer post-labeling delays. So for their implementation, I just did a single echo time just to keep things simple, I think, but they did a much more complicated multiple echo time acquisition to try to capture the traversal of the ASL signal from the blood and tissue to the CSF compartments. And the way that they calculated the exchange times, they used a slightly different model to what I was doing based on, I think, Matthias Gunther's work. And they did calculate quite long exchange times. And I think in the discussion of the paper, there is a bit of a caveat around that. And I know Matthias van Osch is currently working to kind of follow up this work and look at getting a kind of a little bit more precise tri-compartmental distribution. So this is the work of active interest and of active research. And I wait to see other people doing these sorts of long echo time measurements, whether they see similar distributions, because I think it's quite interesting.
It really is interesting. I mean, I mean, it truly is, first of all, being able to infer that with MRI in the first place, but the fact that there are these processes like this that are going on, that at these relatively slow time constants, which suggests a complicated process of exchange between the blood water and the CSF and the tissue water.
Really interesting about that is we don't know the routes that the blood takes to get from the blood vessel to the CSF. It's really hard to know from the data, and it should hopefully be possible to disentangle with further studies. But does it cross, the smooth muscle of the larger arteries? It just intuitively, you wouldn't have thought that would occur. But water is a small molecule, or does it come from maybe the meningeal lymphatic vessels that are connected to the subarachnoid CSF, or is there a more diffuse route? We just don't know, and that would be really interesting to see if we can actually try to understand the path that it takes to get to the CSF.
Yeah, that in itself is just amazing. Because, you look at reading textbooks, you see the standard sort of, pathways and you're realizing that it's definitely more complicated than that and potentially interesting clinically. Mm-hmm. So just to maybe try to wrap up, once again, to revisit the question of what's probably surprised you the most or what do you really think the future is as far as, if you have more maybe physicists collaborating with the neurophysiologists and, ultimately collaborating with the clinicians. Are you optimistic that a robust, clinically viable method might emerge from all this?
So if we think about Alzheimer's disease, there's been these brilliant breakthroughs recently with the monoclonal antibody treatments that can remove amyloid and show a clinically significant improvement. But I guess conceptually, ideally, it would be great if you could stop the amyloid accumulating in the first place. And that's where brain clearance comes in. And if we could use these methods to identify a patient with impaired clearance at a very early stage in life, perhaps middle age, try to intervene lifestyle therapeutically, try to stimulate clearance, then hopefully delay the accumulation of the proteins with the ultimate aim of delaying or even preventing clinical symptoms 20 years later. So I love that concept. And I think that's why it's worth trying to stick to this formidable challenge that we're working on.
Yeah. And to me, at least from looking at the field and how it's evolving pretty quickly, certainly there was some delay between when it was first discovered about 2009 or 10, but now finally it seems like there's this critical mass of MR physics that, sort of approaches that are non-invasive or minimally invasive that give insight. And it seems like things are happening more quickly that we're going to be receive pretty convincing, robust maps of clearance or even of exchange or any part of this process that could be almost immediately useful, like, as you said, clinically, to suggest lifestyle changes, suggest getting more sleep, not smoking, effects of blood pressure, things like that. That's and also ultimately treatment of Alzheimer's. It would be really exciting if, we did realize that, and I realized just looking at the literature of even looking at brain activation and, the standard model was that blood is delivered to deliver oxygen. There's just recently a paper that came out that suggests that, blood is actually increased to remove waste, metabolic waste with activation. So maybe, you know, both the blood flow and now the CSF is, you know, their purpose is to, sure, it's to deliver some things, but also, but mostly to, you know, keep things cleared out as far as that's concerned. So, so which is exciting, which is interesting.
Yeah, fascinating. That might though take us to blood-brain barrier mediated clearance, which is perhaps something that might be beyond the scope of this conversation. Yeah, further complicate things. But yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So okay. So with that, I look forward to seeing your work as it emerges in the future. And I think I really truly think that your work and the group at UCL is, you know, there's really only about a handful at the most of people focusing on this. And I think you're definitely among the leaders. And so I wish you the best. And thanks again for coming on.
Oh, thanks so much, Peter. It's been a real pleasure. And yeah, thanks for your time. It's been great.
All right. Thank you.
Neurosalience is brought to you by Organization for Human Brain Mapping.